Welcome to Starfleet Universe On Call. I am Paul Franz, owner of Franz Games. I run SFB Online, FedCom Online, and Starfleet Warlord. Just a reminder how to join us with a talkcast every Thursday night starting at 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time. You can either call us on the phone, just dial 605-562-0444. Just follow the directions. The call ID is 17702. Or you can participate on the web. Just go to the TalkShoe website at www.talkshoe.com and search for call ID 17702. And if you want to actually see my beautiful face, the podcast is also streamed live over at twitch.tv. So just go to twitch.tv/SFUOnCall and you'll find us there. And you can also participate in the chat room, which is a very lively group. So come and join us. And if you need to contact me for any reason, my email address is sfuoncall@gmail.com. That's sfuoncall@gmail.com. Also, if you want to follow me on Twitter, the same name, which is sfuoncall. And I have a personal account, but if you want to follow me, that's fine. That's Paul Franz, PaulFranz. Just a reminder, I'm an avid O's fan. Don't get me started on talking about baseball. And I love being Catholic, and also I love all kinds of tech. So if you don't want to hear about that, then I would suggest you would not to follow me. Now, of course, also we have the Franz Games account, which is for those situations where you want to keep an eye on what's going on with Franz Games, you know, SFB Online, FedCom Online, then Starfleet Warlord, all of those. And you can follow me there. It's FranzGames, and you'll be able to follow me there. And, of course, the lovely TalkCast gets turned into a podcast available on iTunes and very other feeds around the net. And, of course, the video is available on twitch.tv. That's for a week. It's a free account. And also, I do post a link to the YouTube video, both on the website and on Twitter for that episode, because I do record it, you know, the video, and I do post it on YouTube so people can watch it later if they want to. Some quick news from ADB this week. Very quick news. Two things. I think I mentioned it last week, but I'll mention it again, which is Jean's done her chemo. So things should be starting to get back to normal. And part of that was actually they got a couple new posts. And one of those new posts was just a neighborhood post, which is that they got snow this week. And part of one of those that they got snow. The other one was that, we got snow and we're going to be closed because we got snow. There looks like quite a bit of snow, and it's March. It's like, I'm not expecting this, but you know, it is what it is. Just a reminder that Starfleet Games has plenty of free stuff that you can download, from desktop images to playtest rules, including like Starfleet Battle Force playtest cards that you can download if you want to, print out, possibly even I would go to your local Staples and print out on good card stock, or at least thicker card stock, so that you can actually cut it out and actually use them as cards. Though obviously the problem with using playtest cards like that is, of course, they know what the playtest card is when it's in your hand. So but anyhow. And of course, they have pointers to, if you want to get like the SFB cadet training manual, you can get that. You can get the first missions, which is the introduction to the Federation Commander game. So there's all kinds of stuff like that. So obviously, you want to go there. And also, a reminder that Emerald Design Bureau, ADB. Does have a Twitter account at ADBINC_Amarillo. So it's ADB_Amarillo. Moving onward to the SFB Online tournament. The Sapphire Star 10 tournament is still going strong. They have a few more games to complete. They're more than 50% done, which is great to see. And actually, I had to go correct correct the initial posting because of the case. The tournament reporting page is case sensitive. So if the data is wrong, as in the case is wrong in the data, it won't ever match you. It never actually report the game one way or the other. And it looks like I don't report that you failed. And I apologize for that. I didn't realize that was the case. When it comes to SMB, I actually did a little work on the client, a minor little thing, which I worked on, which is there's a minor issue that if the main screen is off the screen, you'll never see it. And the only way to correct it is actually to open up the properties file, which has saved all the settings in it. So I have a fix for that. It's going to be in the next release that goes out. More to Starfleet Warlord. I actually did a little bit of work on Starfleet Warlord, which is adding the ability to actually create an orders CSV file. So it looks at the report, it creates a CSV file based on the report. So it'll show you, the ships and the orders and all that kind of thing. So if you want to use, as strange as it might sound, a spreadsheet for entering your orders, you can do that. Obviously, I think you would prefer to use the client because the client has special abilities that spreadsheets do not. But if you want to use a spreadsheet, that's fine. Also, one of the reasons I did that was one thing I want to do, which I'm hoping to do in the future, is at the very least a rudimentary aid client on the web, while Dirk gets his stuff all together. I'm not sure how long it's going to take him to do that because I thought it was going to be like 6 months to a year, and it's definitely over a year now. But anyhow, just a reminder also that next week there will be no podcast. I will be on vacation. I will not be able to do a podcast next week. But in 2 weeks, I will be back, renewed, refreshed, waiting to kick some butt. And with that, that is the news for this week. And it means no one else, Paul Franz, becoming you, Starfleet Universe, on call. And tonight, we got Barry. I'm sure we'll have plenty of people in the chat room over on Twitch. And of course, we have Dave. Dave's almost always here. And thank you, Dave. And also, it looks like Chris is also in the Twitch chat room. And Barry, how you doing?
Hey. I was discussing tachyon missiles.
Yeah. Before we go continue on, I want to say hello to one other person. Hey, Gary.
Hello.
How you doing?
Hello. Hey, Gary.
Yeah, not too bad. Hello there, Barry and Paul. So I hope you guys are both doing well.
So we're discussing tachyon missiles. So I was looking at this, and the BPV cost for the upgrades to them is huge. So by comparison, going from a 20-speed drone to a 32-speed drone costs you a half a BPV per drone. For tachyon missile, going from a 20-speed to a 32-speed costs you 1.5 BPVs.
Wow.
And it also decreases, yeah. And then you have a frame size. So a standard frame, say, has a size of 8. Size of 8. And your 32-speed propulsion module burns 4 size points, so you only have 4 points of space left for other stuff. So you got 32 speed, but it costs you triple the amount of as for a drone.
Right.
Now, let's say you want to give it a bigger explosive warhead. basics is explosion 8. To go to explosive 12, every 4 points of explosive you add costs a half a BPV. So if I want to get a 32 speed, oh, I can't do that, and each costs a size point. And every time you go up a size point, you slow it down by one. So an explosion 12 costs a half a BPV. So you'd really have a speed 31 drone. So a 32 speed, a 31 speed size 12 or explosion 12 tachyon missile, which is in some ways similar to a drone. It takes twice as many hit points, but you've spent two BPVs compared to a Type 1 drone, which cost you half a BPV.
Okay, and
how? Now, let's say I want
well,
to go.
Well, Barry, let's, if you want to do this, trying to compare them. Well, let's compare them. How much would it cost to add additional, points of armor to protect, to increase
armor?
And this is to the drone.
Okay, so each point armor costs a quarter BPV and a size point.
That drone, or is that Troban? Tachyon missile.
That's tachyon missile.
I wanted to know how much is it for a drone, because I want to try to measure these two apples for apples as much as possible. Because basically, what you've got is with that tachyon missile with the extra two BPV, it was not just okay. You got 12 destructive. You got a 31, not a 32, but also you have it takes 8 points to kill it.
Well, yes.
So to get four points of armor on a Type 1 drone, and which have to be external to have the same warhead strength.
Yes.
How much would it cost?
Let's see. Drones.
Because Lodge at the moment, we're talking about basically a drone that's better than a drone.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to the master rule book.
Mm-hmm.
FD-10. Okay. So armor, external armor. Armor, they can be in FD-12 is where the armor is, and FD-12 says external armor, no more than one external armor module can be added to any one drone. External armor cannot be placed on a drone equipped with internal armor. External armor reduces the speed of the drone according to the chart below. So
right.
One space. Wow, it really drops the speed, doesn't it?
Yep.
Okay. What about internal armor?
Internal armor, does it take takes up the space that normally used for explosion, explosives.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. The internal. Where is that? Two armor modules available. The smaller occupies a half space point. The larger occupies one space point. The most common armored drones are one space type. One drone with a half space point armor module, half space point explosive module, two space payload. Okay. A given drone can be equipped with more than.
So what you could do is if you had a two space drone, so it'd be a type 4 drone,
yeah,
with one full space of armor and one space of
explosive,
and that's
right. And how much does a one space armor provide in terms of protection?
One space armor gives you 4 points.
Okay, so a one space large drone, a large drone with one space of armor has does 12 points of damage and takes 10 points to kill. And let's see, how much does it cost? Armor costs half a point. So a large drone with one armor module and
two and a half. And do we get trade-ins? I always hate this part.
Frame is effectively free. The propulsion and payload warhead modules. Okay, so explosive module, a one space explosive module costs half a point. Start FD 10.51. So the armor costs the same as the explosive module.
Right. So basically it's free.
Okay. Yeah, basically so if I took a large drone, or let's say I took large.
A large drone is about, it would be around the same. When it comes to, because you think about it, if you have a B-rack with three large drones in it, that's the same as the tachyon missiles where you get three missiles, right?
Right. Well, let's say I put a half space armor into it. And a 1.5 space explosive in it.
Yeah, but that's not the same.
So that gives,
it does.
It has 8 hit points. It's a large,
right.
8 hit points, but it has a warhead of 16.
Right.
Okay, and the propulsion module for a two spaces cost me 32. Or let's say I go to a speed 20. So that's the same as a tachyon missile. So two space, I'm paying 1.5 points BPVs. And I've got let's see. Um, Yeah, 1.5 points. And but I've got 16 damage versus, oh, is that right? Explosive. I'd have 12 and 6. No, I'd have 18 explosion. 18 explosion. Same hit points, same speed. But it would cost me 1.5 BPVs. Now, that's 18 explosion versus 8 explosion. So if I wanted to get the Tachyon missile up to that 18 explosion, let's say I went just to 16 explosion, I would need 1 BPV, but it would drop me from speed 20 to speed 18. I'm slower, slightly less explosion. I cost 1 BPV versus 1.5 BPV. So I'm a little cheaper. But remember that the BRAC has twice the firing rate. And that is a huge difference.
Well, it depends. Well, that's true. Because you can fire one per rack versus one per ship.
Right.
Because you have two racks, but you only can fire one, right? Rack.
Right. Now, the other downside of Tachyon missile is that there's a myopic zone where you launch it, and it takes 4 impulses to arm. Mm-hmm. During which time it cannot hit its target.
Understood. Which may,
yeah.
Which obviously makes it less useful for dogfights.
Yes, that is correct. That is correct. But that half firing rate and the other thing is that drones can be used in scatter packs, which Tachyon missiles cannot.
Mm-hmm. Protects. That brings up in my mind a question is, and that is, are there any Omega ships that are really designed for dogfighting?
Absolutely, there are.
Okay.
The Hivers are really good at it. The Alundas are actually pretty good at it. The Arachnids are really, really good at dogfighting. The Kulagar are actually excellent dogfighters.
Oh, okay.
Those are some of the bigger races. Oh, you don't need to go to B-racks. Let's say you use A-racks. You say, oh, but I only get two large drones. Yes, but A-racks have one set of reloads. Tachyon missiles don't have any.
Mm-hmm. Understood.
So really, with an A-rack, I have one more missile. I have one more drone than the Mazron has missiles.
True.
And if I reduce my firing rate to the same rate as the Mazron, then I can reload in one, fire the other, and alternate. And if I do that, I can fire 8 instead of 6.
Yeah.
So definitely.
Yeah, because I agree that
better weapon.
Yeah. Well, But again, as we come back to sooner or later, which is the same issue, the same question, which is overall, are within the octant of the omega, are they relatively balanced? And I know the answer is no, that there are some that are just much stronger than the others. Because and you know this, Barry. I always had that same feeling, which is that I always feel like comparing omega to alpha is a fool's errand. It's a false
Well, that's why
comparison.
I didn't bring up drones.
Right.
I know, but you brought up drones. I did not.
Oh, no, you brought up drones because you're talking about the cost of tachyon missiles versus drones.
Oh, that's true. That's true. That's true. That is true. I did bring up the cost.
Right.
But I do think that now, if you want to go to the faster drones, all of a sudden, if you look at the propulsion module cost, that speed 22 space costs you a point and a half. Going to speed 32 costs you 2 points. Not much different. Whereas with tachyon missiles, that extra speed costs big time. So you're the propulsion. So a speed 32 costs you a point and a half. So and then if you want to get the explosive up to something decent, you're going to need another, to even though explosion 16, you're going to spend another one BPV. Now you're up to, for a speed 30 with a 16-point explosion, which is still less than the large drone with the armor. You're spending, let's see, one, and then for your propulsion, so 2.5 versus 2 on the drone. Right, and the armor is free. Yeah, so it is okay.
Well,
But the
and
firing rate sucks.
right. The one question I have about that is when it comes to getting, the tactical missiles faster, is when overall do the Omega Empires increase their ships to actually be able to go speed 32?
I don't know the exact date.
I can help you with that if you like.
Yes. By all means, Gary.
All right. So first of all, I should note that if you look at the rules for tachyon missiles, bear in mind that they're covering a period of time from like around Y50 through to about Y200. So they're covering a range of updates that is much more much broader than what you have for drone rules. And also bear in mind that that what we consider to be the middle years lasts significantly longer on Omega than it does in Alpha. So like right now, like if you think of like the standard Neutron or Atari or whatever cruisers and so forth that are out there, most of them, with the exception of ships like the Vari Wing Cruiser, that are in print, are really intended to be compared to, say, an unrefitted Hydrin Ranger, or maybe like a Xinti Strike Cruiser and so forth, or like an unrefitted Fed CA and so forth. So it's only later in the timeline, because Alpha basically pulls ahead quicker than Omega does. Because, like, in the Alpha Octant, you start seeing, like, refits and so forth, those Corinthian hydrogen ships in, like, the Y160, so after the Four Powers War, but just before the General War. And you start seeing things like get higher and higher until you get to Y180 when you start seeing, like, speed 32 drones. And actually, on a side note, I should say that I think in the Alpha Octant, the best comparison to the Mistrons would be the Carnovans from Module C6, because they've got turn mode C, their disruptor cannons are very like tachyon guns, and they have death bolts, which are not quite the same as tachyon missiles, but bear in mind that death bolts are trying to be not drones, because they didn't want to basically have the Carnovans give up death bolts and become yet another drone user. So ADB had to basically think of ways to upgrade the earlier death bolts to be something interesting in the quote unquote modern era that you see in Module C6. But I'll get back to that later. But anyway, so the stuff I'm going to say, a lot of it hasn't actually been implemented in print just yet, but hopefully it will in the future. So according to the timeline, the first Speed 30 warp upgrades start happening in Y173, and that is with the Mistrons and with the Federal Republic. Now, the FRA had the advantage because their light cruisers already could go Speed 31, so it's basically, and also their other ships, like the armored cruiser, are a bit faster anyway. But like they're like more like Speed 29 than Speed 31 or whatever. But so they have less of a distance to go. Actually, I should note that if you're looking at Captain's Log 50, you might notice that the Zosman Marauder playtest ships actually have warp refits available to them. So you can basically pay a few extra BPV to fly the ship that can fight at Speed 30, but background-wise, the warp refit is not universal, so you still might find ships with the slower warp engines later on. So, because my way of seeing it would be that Omega Empires don't have the same kind of luxury that Alpha Empires would have, or that Magellanic Cloud Empires would have, in terms of making such warp refits fleet-wide. So anyway. So yeah, basically you start seeing those kind of warp refits, but you're still using basically the refitted mid-year ships. They're kind of like what, for example, like imagine you're basically trying to think of a word for it. So imagine, say, for example, if the Hydrans were given a year where they could upgrade their Rangers and Lancers to Speed 30, but then they had to wait another 15 or 20 years before they could start fielding their war cruisers and war destroyers. I'm blanking on the names. Anyway, The Mongol and Iroquois. So, but for in Omega, according to the timeline, the first war cruisers and war destroyers, they don't show up until Y187. And again, it's the Mistrons and FRA that are the first to reach that point. And it takes some years after that for other empires to catch up, basically catch up at all, because some of them get destroyed before then. And it's not until Y198 before the first X cruisers come out. And it's not until, I think, Y197 that the, or Y196 that the first true fast patrol ships come out. So a lot of that technology that appears in the Y180s in Alpha, it's only the Y190s that Omega gets around to that. So, yeah, basically, it. And I'd say we haven't seen most of those ships in print, so it's still, I don't know if it's entirely fair to be too quick to look at like the fully tricked out ships in the Alpha Octant that people are used to using in the General War or the Andromeda Invasion, and then comparing them to what we have in Omega historically now, and then complaining that Omega can't match it because it's yeah, I mean it's I mean part of that's like a bigger issue in terms of how Omega was handled, because you know we've mentioned on the podcast before that the Magellanic Cloud was handled better in the sense that Module C5 gives you pretty much everything you need for the main three empires in the LMC at least. Like you've got their warp refits if you have any, you've got their war cruisers and so forth. But I guess Ken Burnside had the advantage in that the LMC is a very small region of space, and so there's only going to be so many empires to do there. So you could pick three big empires and have them be the big three, and now it works. So whereas with Omega, mean, I still don't think that it was handled too well, but the very fact that the octant was so big, no matter which way you went about it, it would have been difficult. So, but I mean, looking back, it would have been nice if they had included the warp refits on the SSDs back then. But I suppose maybe the problem that Bruce got also was that he might have been worried that people would just use the warp refit versions of the chips
right.
and not play them the middle years versions the way that he intended. Because think of it now. I mean, Federation Commander has the separate middle year ship cards and stuff for things like the Hydro Ranger and stuff. And FFB, of course, has like the refit options. But, I mean, how many people are using those? I mean, how many people actually make the point of playing middle years rather than skipping ahead to the General War era?
Right.
So
or playing early years.
You know,
they play those, you know, empires, mm-hmm. you know, at the beginning and have the challenges that are inherent on the early years, you know, chewing gum and moving at the same time, that kind of thing.
Well, I suppose the middle year, the early years have the advantage in that unless you're a Tholian, you don't have the temptation of using the better ships. Because, I mean, like if you're playing early years, you're buying a specific module or three modules for SFP, of course, that only have early year ships in it. So
right.
you're basically forced to embed yourself in that setting. Whereas with middle years, because middle years is kind of blending into the General War era, it's harder to get away from that unless you make the point of saying, I want to, you know, try and use the ships with like the Reaper shields or with whatever. So
right.
but I suppose the other thing too is that, yeah.
Yeah, the only thing I was going to point
That's
out is that
compare,
obviously, it sounds like basically it's the only time you actually see someone playing middle years ships at all is for a specific scenario that they wanted to play out.
Mm. And everybody plays General War. Wow.
Yeah.
I know I pretty much play tournament, which is late General War ships.
Right.
Yeah. Hey, sadly, I have an early
morning. To get up bright and early tomorrow morning. Okay.
Yeah, and I have a flight home tomorrow. Mm-hmm. I have 2 more weeks down in Nashville, so where I fly home every Friday and fly back down every Sunday. And then after that, I'm going to be headed back to California. So
okay, cool.
California should make it much easier. Yeah, California should make it a lot easier for me to be on Talk Shoe, because at least I'm an early morning person, go to bed early, wake
right.
up really, really early. But if I'm in California, that kind of 3-hour difference does make it easier for me.
Oh, understood. Though obviously it could also interfere a little bit if you have to work late, you know. But I don't remember how often that actually occurs, to be honest. So, oh, and reminder, next week we don't have a podcast.
Oh, okay.
I'm on vacation.
Oh, where are you going?
Virginia. We're going to be near the Shenandoah Valley Park. It's near the Lorraine Caverns. So we're probably going to be doing some hiking in the park and also head out to the Lorraine Caverns and probably also just sit around the house and chill, you know, away from everybody, away from everything, you know.
That is a beautiful area. That is a beautiful area.
Yep.
Yeah, my vacation comes the day after Cinco de Mayo, May 6th. I'm going down to Mexico. Cancun.
They're going down to Mexico
just
after Cinco
mind,
de Mayo.
That, well, actually, just one thing is that I gather that actual Mexicans don't really think much of Cinco de Mayo. It's just Mexican Americans who think about it. Because in actual Mexico, they have like other days that they focus on. So
mm-hmm.
it's I wouldn't expect too big a celebration on the day in that country.
Our flight is
May 6th. And we're going to one of these resorts where we have a all-inclusive that basically you pay a daily rate, and then that includes all food, all alcohol, all tips.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. I like those resorts that have that.
Yeah. Then we get back from there, and my wife goes under the knife to get her hip replaced.
Oh, fun.
So we're not going to be walking too many beaches.
Understood.
She's not going to be in any shape to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Good night.
Okay, good night. Yeah, actually, a couple of people talking about Omega, and they think it's one of the things that hurt Omega. Dave's saying that Omega lost some of the Star Trek flavor, but at the same time, obviously Omega and LMC, which are not part of Star Trek canon, that can hurt it, but you know, at the same time, I like some of the ideas that both the Omega and LMC bring forward and give some additional flavor that normally you wouldn't see in Star Trek, you know. And so I like Omega. The one thing that I've always railed against when it comes to Omega itself is the rule book, because the rules make it feel disjointed. The way it's written, I understand they have to do it that way to a certain degree because the main part that makes it feel disjointing is all the phasers. And it's not that they have too many different phasers. It's that they have, basically they say, oh, this phaser is like all, you know, regular alpha octant phasers, but here's the differences, and then here's the differences that are a little different, you know, that kind of thing, instead of having it more of a integrated approach, you know. So anyhow, Gary, were you gonna say anything else about Omega?
Well, I'm trying to think now. My brain's shutting down. But actually, I was just kind of. I do think. I don't know if you have. Do you have a copy of Marshall C6?
Not standing beside me, and I apologize for not having it because I should have grabbed it after last week's podcast.
Well, it is definitely. I'm not going to the Paravians, but in terms of Carnivons too, in terms of like trying to basically look at it, because you could see that they have to try to think of certain ways to implement the Carnivons based on various technology restrictions. But So, for example, the death bolts, they're too big to fit on a fighter or a fast patrol ship frame. So the Carnivons don't have death fighters. And they have death bolt bombers, but they have to be launched from planets. So if you're in a fleet battle with your EDs, or they're gonna have phasers, they're fighting against whatever. But then on things it's I've also never been given drones or the fighters. I would have rather gone. So I think the thing as well is that in the context of Omega, I think it's generally better that the tachyon itself, as we see them, either the launchers, there are more powerful launchers, but they appear later in the timeline.
Right.
It's just that they're using the Zossman Marauders because. Like the pirate ships, you can basically pay racks if you want. But then, I guess, because some of the racks, they don't become available until later in line. So the right is not pointed yet. But the were more like Europe, then it would make the end that use them too difficult, because, like, think of the problems in the alpha octant that the Vizentes cause once you get to the general war era. Because in the middle years, it was fine. They had more of drone racks, but the drones were slower and they had fewer disruptors.
Right.
But then once you get to the war, those drones can go faster and they've got all powerful disruptors and stuff, whatever. So suddenly, like, they're a bigger, they're a more imbalancing factor. And so that's basically how to kind of keep the rest of the octants balanced, which I don't know if that's been particularly healthy for the alpha game either. I mean, so when I hear talk about how imbalanced Omega is, it is worth bearing in mind that alpha is not without its problems. So,
agreed.
I think of all the things they've had to try to give plasma empires, like give them carronades and give them, well, that's against cloaks, I should say, give them things like Sadol and so forth, like speed 40 plasma and so on. And, try to really find a way so that they don't get basically, left in the lurch.
Mm-hmm.
So actually, you could even say that, I don't know whether or not this is an issue that gets solved just by the BTD factor alone, but if we talk about the Paravians in module C6, they don't have a Sable option for the quantum wave torpedo. Like, there is no speed 40 QWT.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same seeking weapon from the beginning of the middle years to the end of the middle years, to the end of the general war. So, and we don't know what an X quantum wave torpedo would look like. And the actual ships that mount them, they don't magically get additional, like, a ton of different launchers. Like, if you compare, like, the Paravian battle cruiser to the Paravian heavy cruiser, it only has one extra quantum wave torpedo launcher. I'm sure the ship has a bunch of extra power, but that power is not going, it's going in different places. So, and the other thing as well is that the way that the rules are written in Module C6 is that, unlike a plasma, quantum wave torpedoes need warp power to overload. And the Paravians don't get warp reactors. And they don't, and also, if you think about that battle cruiser, it's got the same speed 30 warp engines as the heavy cruiser. So again, you're in the same boat where, because you're not basically, you're still using a significant proportion of your warp energy to overload those quantum wave torpedoes,
right,
if that's what you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know whether or not that's a problem in terms of, like, when you get to Y-180, and the Paravians suddenly just crap in the sense that they just can't compete, or does it work out in the sense that even if their ships are suddenly, a much lower PPV rate compared to their ISC or Gorn rivals, if you take enough of them for the point value, are you okay? So I wouldn't want people to basically, I'm not saying that Omega is perfect, like, there's definitely supposed to be fixed,
definitely
but
not.
In terms of what the baseline is supposed to be, I'd be cautious in terms of what the expectation is there as well,
Hmm. Oh, understood. Yeah, that's one of the reasons why I was trying to point out, which is when the Omega ships got basically speed 32 ships, when their ships got upgraded to that, because of, it's a false dichotomy, you can create a speed 32 tachyon missile, costs all this additional BPV. But the question is it needed? Do you need to have these tachyon missiles to be faster than a ship could ever go?
Well, bear in mind that in terms of, like, when this technology becomes available to you, it's basically almost by the time the Andromedans and the Soldiers show up, because they're really the first baseline that applies across both Alpha and Omega. And also because, as you know all too well, the Andromedans are a very difficult empire to use as a baseline because their technology is so radically different.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah,
even if you say, oh, they're good against the Andros, that doesn't necessarily mean, oh, they're good against each other. And also the Soldier as well, they throw up all sorts of challenges and so on because of the very nature of their quote-unquote technology and how they're trying to beat you as opposed to just blowing your ship up, because they're trying to drain your ship's life force.
Right.
So they don't want your ship to blow up. They want you to, you know, be absorbed. So you've got all these, like, things to consider. So, yeah. But, you know, I mean, it would be kind of... You see, I think one of the things is that I personally think Alpha is too samey. I mean, I think that... I mean, it's easy to go back and look at it from 2022, but, I mean, like, if you think about it, an entire octant where everyone uses the same phaser, I mean, and, you know, you've got so many different empires using the same drones, and, I mean, even plasma is the same and so forth, and, like, for
Agreed.
The most part.
Agreed.
Like, there's relatively few empires in the Alpha octant that have, like, the IC have the PPD, which is interesting. And, of course, Thorians have that, but then they're extragalactic, so they really count. But, I mean, the Vudar have their interesting ionic weapon technology and so on. And, of course, the Lyrans have the ESG. But, I mean, there's still relatively few avenues to really, you know, have something be different. So, I mean, it's almost like if people think that Omega is too much, it's too dark, like too complicated. I'd argue that maybe Alpha is just not complicated enough. Like, it's, so, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Oh, understood. The one thing you definitely can say about the Omega is that there is no such thing as cookie cutter in the Omega. You know, because that's one thing that has been complaints about, obviously, in the past. That, you know, a lot of the ships that were created later on in, you know, the life cycle, the life of SFB, have basically been cookie cutter. You know, basically you take this, they have relatively same amount of power, same number of weapons, and all this stuff. The only difference is maybe the shape of the ship itself, possibly some of the arcs. But overall, they turned into, you know, the complaint was cookie cutter. You know, every ship that existed, the same ship class existed in every single empire, which at the beginning of SFB, that was definitely not the case. Because we always think, oh, okay, you got F5. Okay, it's an F5 frigate. No, F5 is not a frigate. F5 is actually, if you look at the ship itself, it's actually a destroyer. You know, but it was always considered a frigate. You know, kind of weird things like that. But, you know, so beginning off with, you know, I don't think anyone would call it cookie cutter, but I think later on in the development of the SFB, that definitely did happen. And I don't think that ever really happened with Omega.
Well, I sure hope. And the other thing as well is that, I mean, part of this kind of goes into Federation of Empire rather than SFB. But the thing with SFB is that the very fact that there has to be an equilibrium, like, at least between the TV empires, like, you can't kill them off. Like, you have to basically make sure that they can survive and still be around. So that basically drives the sense that, you know, everyone has to be able to approach things in a certain way and get to the same point at the end.
Mm-hmm.
But in Omega, I mean, an empire can be destroyed. And, or on the other hand, an empire can rise and then fall and then try to recover and stuff. So
yeah.
It makes sense. Like, for example, like with Tachyon missiles, like, for example, there's a, I can't remember if it's, because one of the options you can put into it is to give it a phaser. Like, it's basically, like, it doesn't replace the warhead, but you can, some of the space that's inside the frame, you can put, like, a phaser in there. And historically, supposedly, when it first came in, it was a bit of an issue for, like, the Colligarm to try to figure out. But it wasn't the big deal breaker. So basically, it wasn't until after the war was over, and then the technologies were able to kind of, like, advance all around. Or in terms of, like, the Actually, a better example of this is if you look at the various fighters that are in Module Omega 5, they basically cover, for the empires that they're made for, they cover the full spread, like through to the Andromedan and Soldier invasions.
Mm-hmm.
And by the very end, they're basically the best that they can be for each empire. But they're still quite distinct in terms of like what they're supposed to do. And like none of them are going to be like an F-14 or an F-111 that you have in Alpha. Which is, of course, not the point, because,
right.
Again, Blue Squad didn't want to have, you know, a gajillion drones overtake the game. So, you know, there's the... But, I mean, there's still basically that process where, like, one empire will come up with a type of fighter that's generally better than the rivals, but it would take a few years for the rival to catch up. Like, not it's not the case that everyone gets the same fighter more or less the same time across the options and stuff. So, and... yeah, so it kind of like, you know, it has more leeway to do that. Whereas, like, in Alpha, you're kind of, you know, just in order to make sure that you end up with the same, with the exception of the LDR, you end up with basically the same group of empires from the beginning of the Middle Years to the end of the Andromedan invasion. So that's, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, rant over. But, yeah. Actually, I do wish, when it comes to the Module C6, I do think it'd be interesting to see more about the Second Empire side of those, because there are a few recent issues with Captain's Log that include rules to play the playtest Paravians and Carnivants in Second Empire scale. But mm-hmm. it's interesting to see how, on the one hand, the Paravians... They're a net addition because they give the ISC and Gorns more to do, especially in the Middle Years. So it's actually much more dynamic in terms of factoring them into the game system. Mm-hmm. But for the Carnivants, it's a real challenge because it's already a bit of a headache to try to balance the early general war between the Coalition and the Alliance. And mm-hmm. so you basically have a problem where you either leave the Carnivants as an on-map empire, where they're in their little corner on the top left-hand of the map, and you either stay neutral, or you have these kind of weird rules where, like, you're sort of on the side of the Klingons, but you're sort of not, because you don't want to be on the same side as the Lurans either. So it's like, how is that supposed to work? Or then, on the other hand, like, I think it'd be interesting if you had the scenario where the Klingons allied with the Carnivants, and then they had to fight both the Khmer and the Lurans. But then you'd have to basically say, okay, well then, how do you make sure that the Khmer and Lurans are not quote-unquote allies because they hate each other still? So it's the mechanics of making that work would be a challenge.
Right, right.
But then on the other hand,
All I was going to say is that that's usually involves some kind of rule in F&E to say, well, you know, if this happens, this must happen. You know, the idea of the F&E rules overall are trying to bring forward the general war in, you know, to a certain degree, but give you flexibility to see how different how if it's played differently, it can actually come with different outcomes. But, you know, there's still certain alliances that take place that are almost they're part of F&E and part of the whole history of the general war, and therefore part of the rules.
Mm-hmm. And the other option for the Carnivants is that they basically they take over the they settle in the wing cluster, and they are able to burst out of it during the general war. But in order to do that, you're basically sacrificing the Xintis, because like the assumption is that by the time the Carnivants burst out, they almost take the place of the Xintis in the Alliance. So then you're like, okay, so that's still not quite the same thing in terms of like, and also bear in mind that, I mean, in Seven Empire, there's already the issue where if you are, for most empires, ironically enough, not with Klingons, but for most empires, if you lose your capital hex,
right,
you can retreat to your off-map zone and they can't come after you. So, like, if you're the Hydrans, of course, like, mm-hmm. the common thing is that historically it's the same true. The homeworld gets taken over, and then they escape to the old colonies and they build up their shipyard there, and then they try to come back. So there's always that basically kind of like escape hatch,
right,
that most empires have. But with the Carnivals and the Cluster, it's even trickier because you're in the Wind Cluster. So, I mean, you think about how difficult it is to get rid of the regular winds, because they're behind that radiation shell. But the Carnivals have entire fleets in there. So it's almost impossible to think about the Coalition being able to muster enough force to be able to get into the Wind Cluster and destroy the Carnivals. So basically, they can't lose. So they can't be defeated in the same way. Like, the most you can try to do is to sweep them from open space. And again, you're thinking, I mean, is that fun either? I mean, like, sure, it'd be interesting to see, but I mean, if you compare that to Omega, where, you know, again, we haven't seen the Ethanibras on the Omega map in terms of like the actual nitty gritty and so forth.
Right.
But, well, you know, again, empires don't have that luxury. Like, if you get beaten, you're beaten. And if you, you know, survive, then you survive and so forth. But nothing's handed to you for free. So it's kind of like, you know, you have to really, you know, stay alert in order to be able, unless you, you know, if you're in game terms, like, you'd have to, like, if you're playing a campaign and stuff, if we ever get to the point where Omega is properly supported campaign wise, like, there's no get out of jail free cards. Like, you have to, you know, play well or you're dead. So.
Understood. Yeah. Actually, that just makes me think about. That, I think, would be a real difficult challenge, which is bringing the whole F&E system to the Omega Octant, because of just how the Omega Octant was so fluid when it comes to the Empire's borders and boundaries, you know, throughout the years. You know, of course, the funny part about that is that, you know, that means they're constantly at war, which kind of makes it weird that some of the weapons weren't improved as much as they could have. At least that's the way I see it.
Well, part of the issue was to do with, I guess, logistics, because like, if you have relatively stable borders and you've got like, the infrastructure in place, you've got the intelligence services. Like, think about it. If you're, I mean, it might be trickier for a Klingon, for example, because, you know, it's difficult to go undercover in Cavinti or Hydran space because you're not a 7-foot tiger and you're not a trash can over. So, but at the same time, the Hydrans, for example, have plenty of exile species. And, you know, it's not impossible for the Klingon to run intelligence agents there. So now the exposure they get to military hardware is not the same, but by and large, it's easier to kind of run those kind of operations to try to learn about what the other guy is doing. But in Omega, it's much more difficult because there's so much diversity between the various species, biologically speaking, that it's a lot harder to go undercover. Like, you know, like, if you're in the Mistrons and you're fighting the Mari, you can't really dress up as a giant spider and go across the border and, you know, sneak around that way. You're going to get caught out real quick.
Oh, agreed.
So, yeah, and then also, if we think about it as well, is that if you are an empire with a certain budget for your military each year, and you've got to, like, if you're in the Alpha Octant, the expenses that you have, I mean, they're not cheap, but they're relatively manageable because you've got a certain amount of monster activity, you've got a certain amount of the Orion pirates, and then you've got intelligence operations on your local borders and so on. But then if you're in Omega, you've got like three basically semi-nomadic threats. Like, you've got the Iodani, you've got the Zoslan Marauders, and you've got the Belosco. And on top of that, you're basically having to invest in your medical core so that you're not getting caught up by the Sigvarians, so that they don't infect your people.
Right.
So, and then on top of that, you've basically got like a broader variety of enemy technologies, because when you think of the Alpha Octant, I mean, I suppose in universe, I think they've said that even though in game terms they operate the same, but in universe, if you look at, say, a Gorn phaser relative to a Kazinti phaser, they're, I guess, the mechanics are a little bit different, but they're still close enough that you can get by. And also, when it comes to the logistics, like everyone uses the same types of starbases, everyone uses the same freighters and the same like other kind of things. So getting access to those is easier. But then in Omega, I mean, they have shown sample freighters, but even those have very different atmospheres inside of them. Like if you have a color car, you have like a water environment tour. That's
right.
What I mean.
Right.
And then you've got entirely different like infrastructures in place. So the economies of scale aren't there. So it's basically the amount of resources that you have that you would invest in, you know, keeping up technology-wise is much more difficult.
Right.
So in that sense, I think it kind of like is more reasonable to say that, you know, there isn't the magic budget that you have in Alpha to be able to stay on top of things. So.
Understood. Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're right. Because the dynamics of Empire are really interesting. And as you pointed out, the one thing that definitely that Alpha Octant has over, just as an Empire speaking, you, a lot of the humanoids in the Alpha Octant, they look very similar to one another, and they're all oxygen-breathing life forms, you know, and versus, you know, some of the Omega Octant empires, as you said, you know, some of them, I forget which one you just pointed out, which basically they live in a water environment.
Yeah, the Coligar, they're like jellyfish, basically.
Right. And then you have some with that are breathe, you know, oxygen nitrogen mix, you know, and then others, you know, it's crazy.
Huh. But yeah, I mean, I suppose, Alpha has a little bit of that when it comes to the hydrants and the tholians, but maybe not enough. Like again, I mean, like even with the ISC. I mean, there's only one of the five species in the ISC that can't really breathe normal air, but all they need is basically like a thing up their nose to, in, you know, add chlorine to their diet, basically, and they're okay. Mm-hmm. So none of them have the same, like, really diverse atmospheric issues that you see in Omega, or in the MC, for that matter. It's like, if you look at the Batavai, for example, each individual Batavai, like the females at least, they're about 1,200 kilograms. And their atmosphere is three times as thick as on Earth. So unless they have the technological assistance, they can't actually hear anything in an Earth-level atmosphere. So they basically have, and that's one of the reasons why, if you look at a Batavai ship, they have lower numbers of hull boxes. Even though the ship is physically the same size as an enemy ship, the hull box level is lower because there's less compartmentalization, because the Batavai need the open spaces for their echolocation to actually work, so they can hear properly and they can, you know, function as a, you know, quote unquote normally in space. So, and of course, I mean, from a prime directive position, I think that's great because, like, it adds so much more flavor to the universe.
Right.
Like, you're basically, as you say, no one. It's not just basically a bunch of humanoids with, you know, funny noses, whatever.
Right.
But
right.
It does also kind of like, when it comes to making the actual mechanics work, because, I mean, like, you have to admit that with the exception of all these problems that drones cause by the Y-180, it's easier to balance ships from one end to another when they all use the same phasers or they have mostly the same technologies and stuff. But when you do decide that, okay, you're actually going to double down on the diversity of the technologies and say, this empire's got wide angle phases and this empire has radiation phases and so on, then you actually have to think about, okay, so how do I actually make it so that you can actually play these games and have fun playing them?
Right.
I can turn on actually not feel that if you pick one empire, basically you're given the I win button. Like you have to, you actually have a challenge no matter who you play as.
Right. Well, at least that you have a shot at winning, you know. Yeah,
Honestly, I think the answer there is
which is why you have some of these scenarios which are asymmetric, where the goal is not to just flat out defeat your opponent, is to complete certain victory conditions, you know, which might be just to escape versus, the other one's to, how his idea is trying to kill you, you know, simple things like that.
Well, that's why I kind of think that, like, in Captain's Log, they have various battle groups. Like, they have a certain number of BKB and then build to that. Or, like, in Fed Commander, because now they don't really do it anymore. But when they did try to do tournaments for Fed Commander, they didn't create tournament ships. They completely went away from that. Instead, they gave you a certain number of point values, and then you chose your empire, and then you picked the ships that you wanted to build up that squadron. And so the concept would be that in between all the ships in your squadron, you're more or less equal to the squadron that you're facing. Now, there's been problems with that in terms of the Plasma Empires, because Plasma is even more problem at Fed Commander than it is in SFB. But the general principle, I think, for SFB and FedCom, I think, is actually maybe more, that's a better point of comparison for Omega than it would be for Alpha, because, I mean, on the one hand, yes, it would be interesting to see, like, Barry's efforts to build tournament cruisers come to fruition. But at the same time, I feel that maybe the point of Omega is less about individual ships, like, against each other class by class. I think it's more to have, like, a squadron of ships and have another squadron, and then between the two, you can make it work.
Agreed. Agreed. Yeah, that's one thing I've always disliked about Alpha, which is many people, they just want to play duels. You know, simple, whether it's frigate versus frigate or heavy cruiser versus heavy cruiser, battle heavy cruiser between battle heavy cruiser, anything like that, versus actually picking a fleet and playing that. Anyhow, I think.
And one final thing on that, because I know
Yes.
we're getting late. I don't want to take too much more of your time, but I think one other problem is that, so if you look at both Alpha, including Module C6, and if you look at the Module C5 for the Magellanic Cloud, one of the handy things is that we pretty much have a full spread of mission variants. So you've got things like commando ships, and you've got things like scouts, you've got tugs and so forth. So you can assemble a force for a broader variety of tactics. And also, like, for example, in the LMC, Ken Burnside actually made a point of actually writing out things to tell you, so this is what a battalion looks like from the bird's eye, and this is generally what you get XYZ, and then here's the lean, here's the magazine and so forth, so that you can actually put proper character to each empire, so that you can make it work more interestingly. But then in Omega, there's almost no commando ships. And there are some scouts, but not very. They're more kind of like middle year scouts, like the same problems that you have in the middle years in the Alpha often, and so on. But in theory, if you did eventually have commando ships and other things, like take the Vari, for example. If you read the history of the Vari, it talks about how their main thing when it comes to dealing with species like the Mistral species and like other species that they can feed on is that they feed on them. So that if you're raiding a colony, you're grabbing the victims and you're, drinking their blood. Or if you're raiding a ship, you're devouring the crew or whatever. But if you look at the various ships that we have in print, they don't have much in the way of tractor beams or transporters or boarding parties. And so you're kind of thinking, well, how are they supposed to actually do what the fiction says they do? And I personally think that one way to solve that could be, if we do eventually see Vari commando ships, I wouldn't be surprised if they take a lot of those. And so maybe each squadron, like if you've got like three or four frigates, maybe one of those frigates is a commando ship by default. So that, and that also might explain why their weapons are so weak ordinarily, because the point is not to destroy your ship. The point is to get your shields down so they can beam over and take over your crew. And So then you're basically, you're putting the Valkyrie in a different category. So not like with the Soldier and the Sigurians. Neither of them are about destroying your ship either. The Sigs want to assimilate your crew, and the Soldier wants to drain their life force. So I think, but the thing is that both of those empires, the rules and the ships that they have, give you the tools to do that. But the Valkyrie don't have those tools yet.
Right.
So I think that for squadron play, for both Death Commander and Starfleet Battles, I think that the Valkyrie, for example, would have a chance of working closer to the way that they were intended to work once we know what the commander ships look like and people can actually take them.
Agreed. Agreed. Okay, well, that is getting a little late here. And so why don't we just wrap it up for this evening? Gary, it was a pleasure to have you around.
Thank you so much. And have a good night.
You
and,
too.
Good luck next week.
Thank you. Thank you. So, had a nice little discussion about, of course, the Omega and with some comparisons to the Alphas, which is, you know, I think an unfair comparison. And especially given not just if you try to compare ship to ship, but then you have the different timelines between the two. And as Gary was pointing out, you know, the some of the big differences there are just the dynamics, but also that the differences in the actual empires themselves, in the, well, not the empires, but the races that make up those empires, and that how they're really that big, there's a big difference between them. And so certain things made it really hard. Yeah, I'm being invaded by learners. I got kitties, you know, quite a few kitties around. But anyhow, with that, I am Paul Franz, and I bid you a good night.